Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the first course at SAI. I hope you will enjoy various courses here. And so this course will be on theoretical mechanics. Of course, the subject of mechanics starts basically with Newton and with his formulation of three laws, the most important one being the force law. However, I will not go into this description of mechanics. Rather, I will describe the Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics, which is like more advanced and effective description of the same thing. And of course, the advantage of this description is that it readily generalizes to quantum theory as well as to field theory. So as you will see soon, if you go to quantum mechanics, there's a very smooth transition from, let's say, Lagrangian description or Hamiltonian description to quantum mechanics, and the same for fields. So the goal of this course, so it will be this week and also next week, and I have basically three goals. So first one will be to review basically the classical mechanics as you know it from your undergraduate course. So review classical mechanics. As you know it, I will also touch on some more advanced topics in mechanics. So some of you may know them, some of you may not know them. So touch advanced topics. And so these will be, for example, maybe you are familiar with Hamilton-Jacobi theory of formulation of mechanics. Okay, so maybe you are, or maybe you are not. So Hamilton-Jacobi theory, which is a very, very powerful formulation of mechanics. Basically, by one equation, you formulate the whole dynamic problem. Integrability. So basically, in your undergraduate courses, you've probably only encountered completely integrable systems. So something which you can really find a solution explicitly. But of course, the reality is quite different. And in general, you cannot do that. And only very, very special class of systems is actually integrable. And I will formulate some conditions which you impose on the system so that you can actually find the solution. OK, so that's an integrability. And also, probably most of you are familiar with what to do if you have some constraints in the system. So that's a second point I would like to do. And finally, theoretical mechanics or classical mechanics admits a beautiful description in terms of differential geometry, which and in particular in terms of the symplectic geometry. So I would like to give you an introduction to symplectic geometry, which of course is a special case if you want of a differential geometry. So I'll give some, discuss some basics of differential geometry. So what tensors are, what manifold is, and stuff like that. And of course, you will use this immediately in your relativity course, which starts in September. Okay, so you'll use that in relativity. But it's independent of relativity, of course, because now we are discussing just mechanics. And so it's a very powerful and beautiful framework for how to formulate these things. OK, so that's the plan. So now I gave you these sheets where you can read a little bit more in detail what roughly the plan is. I don't know if I'm going to cover all the topics, but for the moment, let's have this plan here. So we will start with Lagrangian mechanics. Then I'll talk a little bit about differential geometry so that you have time to digest it. And next week, I will use it to do the symplectic geometry and stuff like that. So there's many great books. More mathematical and probably more correct as well is Arnold, Mathematical Methods of Classical Mechanics. And that's precisely the book which uses the differential geometry. So if you have never been exposed to differential geometry or symplectic geometry, that's the way, that's the place to start. Also, a classical book is by Goldstein. And also useful, maybe David Tong's lectures from Cambridge on classical dynamics. And if you speak Czech, you can also read Podolsky's lectures on theoretical mechanics. So I encourage you to learn some Czech so that you can communicate in my native language. Of course, the mass formulas are the same. So even if you don't speak Czech, you can still understand something. I also, on the wiki, maybe if you were able to log in, I'll place this study text, theoretical mechanics. So the version which is there now, which is this one, is basically from last year. And it has probably many typos and many mistakes, and probably some arguments are completely incorrect and so on. So I encourage you to read it and help me to fix it. So if you find any mistakes, any typos, and you know something is really, really wrong, just tell me and I'll be happy to correct it. And then so that in the end, as a collaboration, we have a text which has less mistakes. Okay? So you can download it from the wiki. I also encourage you to make your own notes. So of course there are some notes available online, but if you make your own notes, I find it very useful. Okay, questions. So anytime you have questions, please ask me. Sorry? Yes. It will be this week, every day, and next week apart from Monday. Okay, so 7 lectures in total. So the first chapter, if you want, will be Lagrangian mechanics. And I hope this is basically a review of the undergraduate stuff you have done. But nonetheless, I would like to do it. And so we start with Hamilton's principle of least action. And so typically when you talk about mechanical problems, you formulate them as initial value problems. So you say, my system at initial time is at some point, and it's moving with some initial velocity, and you are asking where the system is at later times. But equivalent description of this is through the boundary value problem. So basically, you are saying, at one time, the system is here. At another time, the system is here. And so what is the trajectory in between these two positions, basically? So that's an equivalent thing. Well, you may think about it is that you are really solving second-order differential equations. So you need to provide two conditions. These can be two initial conditions on the position and velocity, but they can also be two conditions on one place and another place. Okay, so if you have motion, which is described by generalized coordinate Q of t. So by generalized coordinate, what I mean is that you can basically, in Hamiltonian or Lagrangian description, you can use any coordinate which is convenient for you. And so the only restriction is that you have to have that many coordinates as you have true number of degrees of freedom. Okay, so for example, if you have a pendulum hanging on a rope and it's doing this motion here, of course you can describe the system in Cartesian coordinates through x and y, or z and x if you want. And so you would have two coordinates, but the true degree of freedom is of course only one. Okay, so it's much better to describe the system from the point of view of an angle, so where the pendulum is through the angle. So true degree of freedom is only one. And so it's better to describe, to choose this generalized coordinate to be that angle rather than Cartesian coordinates, because then you would have a constraint. Okay, so generalized coordinate QT, and that can be length or angle or whatever. So we have two equivalent descriptions, if you want. There's the initial value problem . So you just plot q as a function of t. And so this is my evolution of the system. And so in initial value formulation, I just have at time t1, I fix what my q1 is and what my q1 dot is. And then later on, I can find whatever the q at any later time is. So that's the initial value problem. But of course, this is sort of equivalent to a boundary value problem. Where I fixed the two positions. So I have q, it's the same trajectory here, but I have q1 at time t1, and then I have q2 at time t2, and then I'm interested in the trajectory in between these. And of course, this must be the same thing. Okay, so it is this formulation which basically Hamilton did. But of course, the equations of motion will be the same in between. Okay. By the way, this formulation is much more useful in quantum mechanics, where you're asking, so I have initial state, I have final state. What is the probability you get from one state to another state? In quantum gravity as well. So people really like this approach more than that one. But they are equivalent, at least at the classical level. Okay, so now let me formulate the Hamilton's principle. So principle of least action. And it's by Hamilton. Who lived in the 19th century. And I think he formulated it when he was something like 27. So time is ticking. So you should discover something huge very soon. OK? So the principle says the motions of mechanical system in time interval in t belonging to t1 and t2, so it's precisely this picture here, are given by extremals of the action functional and so the action functional, so you have S, it's the standard name for the action functional, and so it's a function of the trajectory. So functional is a function of a function, if you want. So this is S of Q of T. So this is my trajectory, which is function of time, if you want. And so function is a function of this. And it's given by integral from T1 to T2 of a function which depends on the trajectory, on the derivative of the trajectory and time, and you integrate this over time. Okay, and so L is called Lagrangian and of course it's given by the concrete dynamical system, so determines dynamical system. So it's something really, you specify L and then your dynamics is specified and you know that the motion will be given by the extremals of this functional here. Okay, so questions? Yes?
So if we have a system that we know can be described by boundary value problem.
Okay.
Does it imply that it's the way we describe it using something that looks like a least action principle, like with an integral?
So you are asking, well, you put that boundary value problem. So I would say in that case, yes. But of course, not every system can be described by this description. So for example, if you have friction and you are losing energy on stuff like that, then it's much more complicated to use this formulation here.
Yeah. But for the cases where it's possible to use,
do we know that, so if we know that the system can be, well, generally at least, can be described by a boundary value problem, does it follow that it follows, it will look like, so is there a possible derivation or
Well,
why it should look like a functional, for example, based on the fact that it's a boundary value problem?
You are asking a good question. I don't know. Certainly, if you start with Newtonian mechanics, for example, you can show that for certain systems, you can go to this description. Okay, so there is a direct way, you know, if you want, from Newtonian formulation to this formulation. I don't know if there is any proof that you can always do that. I would think so, but I don't know. Okay, so we have this traditional picture. So to derive from here the equations of motion for the dynamical system, you consider these fixed points, consider these fixed points. So, as the picture, so you have Q, you have T. So now you know that your system at time T1 is here, your system at time T2 is here, and you are trying to find the trajectory. And so, of course, there may be many trajectories going that way. And so the question of which one is the right one, and here's the answer. So if you consider the nearby trajectory to the true one, so let's say this is the true trajectory here, and if you consider the near one, this is for fixed t. So I have some q of, so this is my q of t. That's the right trajectory, this one here. And this is the nearby trajectory, so it's q of t plus delta q of t. So this guy, the difference here at a fixed time is delta q, then you are asking when the corresponding function is extremized, if you want, or the delta of that s is equal to 0. Okay, so this is the picture. So fixed end points, you see the delta at t1 is equal to 0, and delta q at T2 by this formulation is also equal to 0. So you really fix the variations here and there. But inside, you can have arbitrary variation. And so we seek extremum so delta of S, where S is given over there, which is S of q of t plus delta q of t minus s q of t equals to 0. So that's the prescription for how to find the true trajectory here. Okay. So now notice very important thing here is that this delta q, which I'm considering here, is really for fixed t. So I fix my time t, and I consider that the nearby trajectory has is shifted by some delta q, but it's at the same time t. Okay, so that has a consequence, is that basically this variation delta sort of commutes with the time shift, or with time derivative, if you want. So really, the time derivative is doing something like this. It's moving you in that direction. But the delta thing is moving you in that direction. And so then there is no surprise, is that you obey the identity, so we have identity, which follows just from the definition of what you mean by delta. You have identity that delta of d over dt is the same as d over dt of delta. Okay, so this is how delta is defined, if you want. And it's obvious from the picture that the time derivative has nothing to do with the delta, because delta is for fixed t. Okay. So now you have the prescription, and now we just do, of course, this is nothing else than a functional derivative, which is something complicated, and you will discuss it in 2 weeks with Dan. But let's just do it, let's just treat it as normal partial derivative. And so then we have this very simple thing. So we just put delta everywhere, right? So delta of s is delta of L dt. That's our functional here, t1 to t2. So now this delta doesn't do anything with time. So you can actually pull it through this integral. But it doesn't do anything to this measure dt because it doesn't do anything with time. So this is just equal to integral delta L dt. Of course, L depends on Q and Q dot. So this is equal to an integral. So dl over dq and delta q plus dl over dq dot delta q dot. And that's it, dt. So now what you do is, so what really stands here is delta of dq over dt. So now I use this identity here. So this one equals to that one. So I'll pull that dot through that. Okay. So this guy is actually d over dt of delta q. And now you integrate by parts. You pick up some boundary term, which you throw away in the end anyway. So you have an integral of dl over dq, and then minus d over dt of dl over dq dot of delta q. So that's if you integrate by parts, and it's still a thing. And then you have the boundary term, so plus dl over dq dot delta q. And this is evaluated at t1 and t2. Yes?
So I'm a little bit confused because we're bringing in the delta, and you said that it doesn't matter that it that we're bringing it into the integral because it only affects one point in time. But then we're affecting it the whole integral. Then it's, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. So we're bringing it in, and that's okay because it's only for one point in time, but now it's affecting the whole integral, so why is that okay?
I mean, why doesn't that go on this dt? Or
no, I think it got that, but it just, if the delta is only supposed to be for one part of the...
No. So delta is defined everywhere. So I will have, at another time, I will have this delta here, right? So this is my delta q at later time. This is my delta q at later time. But the point is that this delta sort of acts only in this direction. It keeps the time fixed, okay? So anything which actually has time in it is untouched by delta. So that's why, for example, this L is a function of Q, Q dot, and T. But of course, I am not doing delta T, because delta T is equal to 0. Okay, so that's why I'm only varying with respect to Q and with respect to Q dot, but T is fixed, for example. Yeah, if you want. Yes. I'm just missing
dt.
Yes, dt. Thank you so much. So now, the boundary term, because we consider the fixed endpoints, so delta q1 and delta q2 are equal to 0. So if you plug it here, delta q1 and delta q2 are 0. So the boundary term is identically equal to 0. And then you require that the trajectory is such that delta s is equal to 0. So you impose this equal to 0 for any variation delta q. So for any nearby trajectory close to my trajectory, this must be equal to 0. So for any delta q, this guy has to be equal to 0. And so the only possibility is that this is equal to 0. Okay. So we derived the Euler-Lagrange equation. And so they are dl over dq. Now I put an index I, which so you can have more. So for example, pendulum is described only by one generalized coordinate, but you have systems which need more than one. Okay, so this index I will enumerate how many coordinates I have. Okay, minus d over dt dl over dq dot I equals to 0. Because I'm requiring that this guy equals to 0. So that's the condition. And so if this must be equal to 0 for any delta q, the only possibility is that the integrand is actually equal to 0. And so this index I runs from 1 to n, where this is the number of true degrees of freedom. Okay, and so this is really the equation of motion for your system. And I don't know who originally found it, but it's called Euler-Lagrange equations, probably independently, both guys. Okay, questions? So now let me have a few remarks. So who has seen this? Everybody. It's trivial, right? Trivial. Okay. So first point is quite interesting, and you will deal with it today in tutorial. So we considered Lagrangians, which were functions of qq dot and t. So now if you look at the resulting equation of motion, so L depends on q and q dot and t. So it has q dot in it. So in general, this will have q dot, but you are taking one more time derivative. So this is a second order differential equation. So second order ordinary differential equation. Okay, but funny thing is, what happens, and maybe some theories actually require that, is that if you consider more complicated Lagrangians, so for example, if you have q, q dot, and q double dot, okay, so what are the resulting equations of motion, and what can you say about the system? And you will play with that in a tutorial. But here, if you just have the standard situation, it just gives you the second order equations of motion. So second remark. So I told you that L is something which characterizes your system. And so what you can show is that for a typical mechanical system, L has this form where T is the kinetic energy. And V is the potential energy. Okay, so this is typical form L takes. So it's really related to energy. So you translate it complicated problem of Newtonian mechanics, where you deal with various forces. Some of them are true, some of them are induced by a wrong coordinate system or something like that. Anyway, it's a vector equation. So now you basically translated everything into knowing what the energies are. So this is much, much simpler formulation, if you want. And so if you don't believe this, just read Landau and Lifshitz. There is a beautiful derivation where he starts with the free particle. And he really shows that in that case, I have to have L equal to kinetic energy of this particle. And then he proceeds to potential and so on. So this can really be sort of derived. Okay. So finally, and this is a very important point, is that L is not defined uniquely. L is not unique. And so what you can do is that you can consider L prime of q, q dot, and t, which differs by the old L by adding a total derivative, q, q dot, and t, and then d of lambda, q of t, over dt. So now, if I consider such L prime, which differs from the old L by adding a total derivative of some function L, lambda, which depends only on the position and time, then the statement is that D gives same equations of motion. Okay, so lambda is arbitrary function, which however depends only on Q and time. It doesn't depend on Q dot. Okay, so that's a very important point. So, okay, so now how to show that, that there's this freedom is, well, either you can take this equation and, you know, start with L prime here, and then you do this horrible differentiation with respect to dt and so on. And in the end, all the ugly terms which depend on this lambda should cancel. And you find that it's exactly the same equation as for L. So that's one way to show this statement. A little bit nicer way is this one. So of course you use a proof. Is that you consider, of course, this S prime, which is now integral of L prime dt. So that's not a derivative, it's just a different. Okay. So which is nothing else than L dt, which is the original S, plus d lambda dt dt. That's what it is. So this is S plus lambda evaluated at t1 and t2. Okay. So now if you consider variations, so delta S prime is of course delta of S, and then plus, and now lambda depends only on Q. So plus d lambda dq delta Q. Of course, I'm misusing the notation here a little bit, but the result is correct. So lambda depends only on Q. It doesn't depend on Q dot. And so that's why if you make the variation, you sort of have this thing here. But of course, again, I impose the fixed endpoints condition. So delta Q at T1 is equal to 0, and delta Q at T2 is equal to 0. So this term actually is 0 by fixed endpoints. And so you see that if delta S is equal to 0, delta S prime is also equal to 0. Okay? So which shows the statement that really the extremals have to be the same. Questions? Okay. So that's about Euler-Lagrange equations and the principle of least action. So now part B is really, you have written down some equations of motion, so how to solve them. Okay. And you can basically solve them analytically only if you have the equations are special, or only if the Lagrangian is special, if the system is special. In other words, if it admits integrals of motion. So part B would be integrals of motion. So solving Euler-Lagrange equations, so this equation here, for most of the systems, you have to either do it numerically, or if you know that the system is close by to some other system which you know how to solve, then you can do it perturbatively. So for example, if you want to really solve the true motion of Mercury around the Earth, around the Sun, then you sort of approximate that by, let's say, Newtonian trajectory or by circular trajectory or whatever. And then you are trying to find relativistic corrections to this. And so you treat the system perturbatively. And so you do expansion in small deviation from that trajectory and so on. So if you know, if your system is close to some integrable system, to some known system, you do it perturbatively. Finally, you can do it analytically. But as I said, basically for zero measure number of systems, and that's for integrable systems. And there's only a handful of them in the nature. So your system has to be really, really special to do it analytically. Okay. So now let me look at this. What are the conditions when you can actually do it analytically, when you can really solve these equations? Okay. And so definition. An integral of motion, integral or constant of motion is a function I, which is a function of q dot and t, such that di over dt equals to 0 for any q of t solving equations of motion. Okay, so it's basically something, so if you have your trajectory here, something which remains constant along that trajectory, has the same value here as the same value here. So it doesn't change as you evolve the trajectory along the motion. So this is a definition. So now if you can find enough of these integrals of motion, or enough of these constants of motion, then you can actually integrate the system. You can actually write down the solution. Okay, we will see explicit examples of this. So now there is a beautiful, beautiful theorem which tells you basically how you know that your system admits integrals of motion. And it's due to Noether. So it's 100 years old theorem, and it's still probably one of the best theorems we have in physics and mathematics. And it's so what it does, it connects the geometrical properties of the space-time, if you want, or the geometrical properties of your underlying manifold, where the motion occurs, with these integrals of motion. Okay, so so we'll discuss Noether's theorem. And if you want, it geometrizes physics, so it discusses connections between symmetries and integrals of motion. Okay, so now to formulate it, let me just first introduce some terminology. So terminology. So the first point is, probably you have heard these terms. So something is valid on shell or off shell. Okay, so statement. And is valid on shell. Of course, this is a misuse of language, which comes from high energy physics, where really the particle either is the true particle or virtual particle or something like that. But let's just use the terminology and let's get used to it. So on shell, that means is that it's valid. Provided the equations of motion are satisfied. Equations of motion are satisfied. Okay. Okay, and the statement is valid of shell. So no conditions imposed. So I'll be at work in 10 minutes from home, provided I satisfy all the laws of physics. But the statement is that, okay, so that's a stupid example, sorry. Anyway, so on-shell means equations of motion have to be imposed, and off-shell means they are not. Okay, so second terminology is about types of symmetries. Types of symmetries. So let me be very concrete, and let's write something which doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't matter. So you are allowed to do some transformations with time, some transformations with coordinates, and so on. And then you are asking, you know, what's happening with my equations of motion, or what's happening with my action? Is the action actually remains the same if I do, if I, for example, translate in time, or if I translate in space, and so on. So let's be very concrete. So consider transformations so I can change time, t goes to t prime, which is my original time plus delta t. So this delta will be different than the delta used in equations of motion. And I'm also able to choose to change my trajectories to q prime at t prime equals to q of t plus delta q of t. Okay. So I consider such transformations. Of course, I would like to have these to be infinitesimally small. So I will parameterize this delta t and delta q. So delta t, I'll just write it in this suggestive form, epsilon times some other delta t. It's a stupid notation, but doesn't matter. And then delta q will be epsilon times delta q. So what I mean by this is that epsilon is the parameter and this delta t will be related to generator of the transformation. So in other words, you are, for example, taking your system and you rotate that system around the axis. So now the generator will tell you, I really rotate the system, okay? And the parameter will tell you how much I rotate the system. Is it 1 degree, 90 degrees, or whatever? So the parameter describes how big is the transformation. So this is how big the transformation is. And this specifies what type of transformation I'm considering. I'm moving everything, you know, apart, or I'm rotating system, or whatever. So what transformation so that's what generator describes, and the same here. Okay, so now now you want to do something with the system, and you want to see that the system after the transformation sort of remains unchanged. Okay, so what type of transformations I can do so that the system doesn't change? And so based on what this epsilon has to be, you can describe various types of symmetries. Okay, so one division is that symmetries are either discrete or continuous. So for example, if you have a rectangle and you rotate it, then you know So you rotate this, and you know that to get the same shape, you need to rotate it by 90 degrees. Okay, if you rotate it a little bit less, you don't get the same picture if you want. Okay, so in this case, you have a discrete symmetry because the epsilon so epsilon has to be discrete to get the symmetry. Another example would be I have a lattice of atoms. So you know that in order to get the same picture, I can, for example, move the lattice, everything I can move, you know, one lattice aside next to it, next. And then, but you see that if you move it only a little bit for an infinitesimal epsilon, then you get something new. So you really have to move it all the way of this lattice constant A. Okay, so now if you have discrete symmetries, then they don't imply any conserved quantities. Okay, so no conserved quantities. So the space has a translation symmetry. So if you move space a little bit apart, then it still looks the same if it's empty space. So that guy actually has continuous symmetry. So epsilon is arbitrarily small. If you have lattice, you don't have continuous symmetry, you have only discrete symmetry. And that's why the translational symmetry, discrete translational symmetry, doesn't help you. Okay. So that's first. And then second, independent division is you can have global symmetries or you can have local symmetries. So by global means is that epsilon here is constant. By local, it means that epsilon in our setting is function of time. If you consider fields, then again, global symmetries will be you move everything by a constant shift or something like that. Local, you'll have a function of space-time coordinates. Okay. So now the distinction here between these two symmetries, between global and local, is very, very subtle and very, very confusing. So the first one, so I would say, so there's a confusing distinction. So the first one leads to the first Noether's theorem. So certainly, if you have either this symmetry or that symmetry, you learn something about the system. But you learn different things. So in case of global symmetry, you have first Noether's theorem, which gives you conserved quantities. Conserved quantities. Integrals of motion, if you want. Quantities. Okay. In case of the other symmetry, this is solved by second Noether's theorem. Sometimes people studying field theory, they say, well, this is something like gauge symmetries. So this is a gauge symmetry, local or gauge symmetry. Gauge symmetry. And so as a result, you don't get any conserved quantities, but you get so-called Bianchi identities. So something again which can sort of help you to understand, the properties of the equations of motion, but not necessarily allows you to solve them. So if you have enough conserved quantities, enough conserved integrals of motion, you can solve these Euler-Lagrange equations. If you have local symmetries, it's something more subtle and something more difficult.
You said for discrete symmetries, there are no conserved quantities.
Yes.
But I remember from quantum mechanics, like if you have parity, then the parity of the state is conserved or something like that.
Well, OK. That's fair enough. But I wouldn't call that a Okay, let me think about it. Yeah, that's fair enough. But you know what I meant here is really I have this type of symmetry where I have a continuous analog of that symmetry, and so if I have only discrete, then it doesn't give you integral of motion. And typically, you know, for the space, if you can move it infinitesimally close by, you get conserved momentum, for example. So there is nothing like conserved momentum on the lattice. Okay, so yeah, but interesting point. Okay, so we have these global and local symmetries, and the distinction is very, very subtle. And moreover, there are recent papers that, you know, people thought that, for example, general relativity is a gauge theory. It has nice this local symmetry. It has, you have Bianchi identities. Everything breaks down when you have actually boundary into your space-time. So some of these symmetries actually become global symmetries on that boundary. And so suddenly you have some true integrals of motion and so on. And that may actually solve the information paradox. Maybe. So there are recent papers by Hawking that basically, you know, the distinction between global and local, and by Strominger and these people, that actually, for example, for gravity, there are some subtleties between these two things. But anyway, for us, I'll only discuss global symmetries in this course. So I will not discuss Bianchi identities. Okay. So now let me formulate Noether's theorem for the global symmetries, the first one. And I will, during the course, I'll give you several versions of this. So probably the most general and the nicest version. So Noether's theorem. Version one. So very general statement, for every global continuous symmetry, of the system, there is a corresponding on-shell integral of motion. Okay, so really there's a one-to-one correspondence between global continuous symmetries and these integrals of motion. And so let me do an example, the non-trivial one. So the statement is, you look at the system, you look at the Lagrangian which describes your system, and you observe that it doesn't depend on time. So L is not an explicit function of time, so it's function only of Q and Q dot. It's only an implicit function of time. It depends on time only through Q and Q dot. So if it doesn't explicitly depend on time, and the statement is that the following quantity E, which is dl over the Q dot I minus L, is conserved energy. Okay, so it's an integral of motion, which is preserved in time, and it has this explicit form. So you see that Lagrangian doesn't depend on time, and this is the prescription for how to find the energy. So of course the proof for this is very simple. So we can even attempt it on the blackboard. So all you have to do is to calculate dE over dt, and observe that it equals to zero, provided the Euler-Lagrange equations are satisfied. Okay, so let me do it So there's a summation. So here I'm using the summation convention, Einstein summation convention. So you sum over all I. So it's Q1, Q1 dot, Q2 plus Q2, Q2 dot, and so on. Okay. So d over dt, nothing changes if I add this index I, so I'll just do it for no index. So it's d over dt, you just have to differentiate this guy. So it's dl over dq dot, q dot, I'm using the Leibniz rule, plus dl over dq dot, q double dot. So that's from the first term, product of two terms. And then minus dl over dq, q dot, minus dl over dq dot, q double dot. That comes from differentiating L. And then I would have also a term dl over dt. But of course, L doesn't depend on t, so that term is not there. Okay, so these are the terms I have. Now you observe that this term is the same as that term. Okay, and so you get this quantity here, q dot, and this quantity here, q dot. And it's nothing else than if you look at your Euler-Lagrange equations multiplied by q dot. So this is just q dot times Euler-Lagrange equation. And of course, if you are on shell, Euler-Lagrange equation is satisfied, so it's equal to 0. So this guy is equal to 0. So you've shown that really this is an integral of motion. Okay. Another example two is typically, if L doesn't depend on some coordinate Q, so L does not depend on some Q, this is some special Q, so this is called cyclic coordinate. So let's say I have a complicated problem which depends on X, Y, and Z, but L, if you look at L, it's independent of X. Okay, so it only depends on y and z. So then you would say x is a cyclic coordinate. And so if you look at your Euler-Lagrange equation, if L doesn't depend on that q, then of course dl over dq is equal to 0. And you have that d over dt of something equals to 0. In other words, that something has to be preserved. Okay, so then you have that p, which is that something, dl over dq dot c is an integral of motion which is preserved in time, and it's called momentum generalized . Why generalized is because I haven't told you that q has to be, for example, x coordinate. So if it's x coordinate, then p is nothing else than the corresponding momentum in the x direction. However, if you, for example, consider generalized coordinates to be your angle, okay, then the corresponding concept quantity, the generalized momentum, will be angular momentum in with respect to that angle. Okay, so this is another conserved quantity. So this is very, very two simple explicit examples. So now let's go to that horrible general formula. That's the only difference between high school and university professor is that the high school professor, somebody wipes the blackboard for them, whereas the university professor has to do it on his own. Okay. So the horrible formula, so Noether's theorem, version 2, which would be like explicit set formula for how to find this contact charge. And so the statement is, so let delta tilde be a global continuous symmetry of the action. So that means that is an of shell we find delta t and delta q such that and let me be simple, so such that delta s equals to 0, such that the action doesn't change. So you take your action, which is given by a Lagrangian, and you play with it, and you find that if I do something with time and something with these generalized coordinates, the action actually remains the same. Okay, so the delta s is the same as the original one. Then you have an explicit expression for this integral of motion, which is given by dl over dq dot delta q, and then plus l minus q dot dl over dq dot and delta t. And so this is an on-shell integral of motion. Okay, this is a very, very explicit prescription. So really, you are given the action, you mess with that action, you have to find what these transformations are so that the action doesn't change. And this must be true off shell. This is very, very important. So you are not, when you are messing with the action to find whether there is a symmetry or not, you are not imposing the equations of motion. Okay, you cannot do that. So it has to be really for any trajectory, it has to be really off shell. So you are messing with the action, you find delta t and delta q such that this is true. And once you do that, this is a prescription for how to find the integral of motion. And the integral of motion, of course, remains constant on the trajectory, so when the equations of motion are satisfied. So this is very strange, right? So you're finding off shell here, and then something is valid on shell. Okay, very, very subtle. Okay. And so you can find these two examples, which we had before as special cases. So for example, let me just introduce these notions. So if I consider delta t and delta q to be, so this is my parameter, which has to be global, so it does not depend on time. And it must be continuous, so it must be infinitesimal. So I consider that I change delta t, but I don't do anything with delta q. So in other words, I move the system in time. And so if this is to be symmetry, my system has to be static or stationary. It doesn't depend on time. The energy doesn't depend on time and stuff like that. So there is a time translation. Time translation you do, and if the if the action remains invariant, then the integral will be energy. So if something doesn't depend on time, the energy is conserved. if something does not depend on space, so I don't do anything with time, but I do something with the space, then I have space translation, and the conserved charge will be momentum. So in general, the space times is homogeneous, so you can actually do translations in time, and you can do translations in space, and the space time doesn't change. So this is homogeneity of space time, of space and time. Okay. So finally, as I said, you can do, for example, this delta q doesn't have to be really x and y or whatever, but it can be an angle, for example, phi. So if I just change that angle and I observe that the system is invariant, then this describes space rotation. And the corresponding integral of motion is angular momentum, and the corresponding symmetry is described as isotropy. So if you are looking, for example, our universe is isotropic, if you are looking that direction, or that direction, it looks the same. So you can do any rotations and still looks the same. So the universe is isotropic to first approximation. So this one is Q, and this one is an angle phi. Sorry for that, phi. So it's exactly the same thing as here, but now I'm choosing the generalized coordinate to be an angle, and then I'm describing rotations, and I have isotropy. This quantity here, the integral of motion, if you plug it into this horrible formula, will have an interpretation of angular momentum.
So you said that there can't be any dependency on time for the time translation. So what about something that's repetitive, like a pendulum? Energy is conserved in a pendulum.
Exactly. So your Lagrangian will not explicitly depend on time. And you can do sort of like time translations, and it will still look the same.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean that the trajectory doesn't depend on time. It does, but for example, Lagrangian doesn't. Okay. Okay. So now, okay. I don't have really enough time to show, or I can show that maybe. Let's see. Just a few steps. So. I want to really stress here that these variations delta tilde, which are given here, okay, are different from the delta which used in when we are deriving the equations of motion. And so the best picture to think about is I'll try to sketch the thing. So, okay, very good. So here we go. Well, I'll plot it again. I think the proof is very instructive because it really shows you what's different in one derivation and what's different in the other. So to discuss the proof, let's see if we have enough time to complete it. So the first thing is to distinguish delta and delta tilde. Okay, and so there is two differences. So first of all, when we were doing the equations of motion, we considered these variations delta, so there was a q and t, and we considered the variation delta, so this was delta q at fixed time t. So the time was fixed here. And so we considered this delta of q at t. But we also had fixed endpoints. So we had this delta q, and we had fixed endpoints. Okay. So delta q was 0 at time t1, and delta q was 0 at time t2. But this delta here just moved in this direction. It didn't move in time direction. Okay. So this is what we were doing when we were deriving the equations of motion. However, when you talk about Noether's theorem, you are doing something very, very different. So this is, again, your q and t. But now, first of all, you are doing this delta tilde. But moreover, you don't consider fixed endpoints. So for example, if you take your space and you want to move it a little bit, you know, aside, of course, you move your fixed endpoints. So it doesn't make sense to consider fixed endpoints. You move the space, so I'm not fixing the endpoints. Okay, so the variation there now is that I have this thing here, and I have that thing there. Okay. So now, the delta without tilde would still go in this direction, up and down, without touching time. But delta tilde can change time. Okay. So delta tilde actually takes you from one time to another time. So this is delta tilde of q. And if you want, this guy is delta of t. So you are changing both. You are changing now time as well as the coordinates. You are moving to a different time. And this is what you mean by delta tilde q. Okay. So there is So delta of q would still look like that. But in Noether's theorem, it doesn't have fixed endpoints. What it means is that you cannot throw away the boundary terms. So the boundary terms will remain in the calculation and play actually the role of the conserved charge. So here, not fixed endpoints. So two important differences. Delta tilde is different than delta. It can move in time as well. And not fix endpoints here. OK, so now let's look at what you mean by this thing. So of course, delta t is defined over there. So delta t is just t prime minus t. So if you have delta of d of t, well, it's just dt prime minus dt. Well, that's obvious. And then d delta t. And you can write it as d delta dt dt. OK, so for time, this is quite simple. D delta t. So now, if you have q is defined over there. So delta q of t, delta q of t, from this definition here, is q prime of t prime minus q of t. Q prime t prime minus q of t. So it's defined differently. And so to relate this delta tilde to my delta, I need to do the Taylor expansion. Okay, so this is q prime of t, and then plus delta tilde t dq prime of t dt plus other terms. So I'm expanding around t. So I'm expanding the first term here, t prime. I'm expanding around t, and then minus qt. Okay, so now you have q prime of t minus q of t, which is my original delta. So Well, this is equal to delta q of t plus delta tilde t dq prime of t dt. Okay, so now this was for q, but you can easily show that the same thing will apply. So you're sort of getting an identity that delta tilde is given by delta plus something here. Okay, so let me write it. So you can guess from here that delta tilde acting on any function of q and q dot and other things is given by the original delta plus delta of t d over dt of that function. So this is an identity which can be verified for any function of q, q dot, and t, okay, by the same argument as we did it for q. Okay, so and now you can use this, and you can read through the notes the proof if you want, which really shows that now I have to actually so then the proof is very simple. You basically have that delta s tilde equals to 0, but now delta s tilde is delta tilde on s is equal to 0. So now you have delta tilde, and then we have L dt. But t can also change now. Okay, so that's why this delta tilde acts on both terms. So you will have to use the Leibniz rule. It will act on L and separately on dt. And then you can massage it. You have to keep track of the boundary terms. Okay, and you can read through three lines in the note. And then you use the equations of motion in the end. So some terms are killed. But you have to keep track of these boundary terms. And these boundary terms, so in the end, you find that this is equal to d over dt of some I. Okay, and so, of course, this is equal to plus something which vanishes, which is proportional to Euler Lagrange equation. So this guy is equal to 0. So now what it tells you is that this quantity EI, which you find there, is the same at time equal to t1, is the same as time at equal to t2. So this is really your conserved charge. And it's given by this boundary term there. Okay. So go through those notes if you want. And that completes the proof. And you really recover this remarkable formula here. Okay, so now this is very, very explicit formula and very, very explicit way how to do it. And really the key point is to realize what is the difference between this picture and that picture here. Okay, so that's the key difference. So you're doing completely different things, basically. Okay, so now in tutorial, there is a third version of Noether's theorem, which I call sneaky version. Okay, so people doing string theory and field theory like that theorem in that version, because it allows you actually to find this Noether charge, this integral of motion very, very quickly. But the reasoning behind this Noether's theorem is very, very sneaky and very, very subtle. So we will discuss that in tutorial, but it's very, very confusing. So that's why I don't discuss it here, because it would completely confuse you. It's already confusing that the statement is, I have to study the symmetries of the action off shell, and then I find integral of motion on shell. That's already confusing. So now they elevate that, and they have like three very, very subtle points here. So they promote the continuous symmetries. Well, they promote the global symmetries to local symmetries. And then they massage the equations. And then they find somehow the conserved charge out of that. But you will see in tutorial. So let me stop here. And tomorrow you'll go. So this is the end of Lagrangian mechanics. You're done with Lagrangian mechanics. And tomorrow we start differential geometry. Questions?
Can you explain that equation?
Which equation? This one?
Yeah.
No. So this guy is just a definition. So I define my new delta to be q, new q at new time. Because now I'm changing time as well. So I have q prime at t prime minus q of t. That's just the definition.
Okay.
So now I have to find, I want to relate this new delta to the old delta. Okay. So the new the old delta was just defined q prime of t minus q of t. I just changed q, but I kept t fixed. Okay. So this is my delta q as I defined before. So how you do that, of course, you want to relate this t prime to the old t. And you do that through Taylor expansion. So you expand this q prime in terms of t. And then I'm doing Taylor expansion to the first order. You can have, of course, many other terms there. And so this is just the first derivative term in the Taylor expansion. And then I'm throwing away the other boundary terms. And then I just write down the q of t. OK, so now I observe this guy with this guy. They combine to delta q of t. But this term remains there. So this term is this term here. And so now this was, so this is the equality here, which I derived for q. But now you can generalize that, and you would see if you do. So you take now any function of q, q dot, and t. Of course, the calculation is more messy. But maybe you can sort of believe me that you get sort of an operational identity between delta tilde and delta. And so that will be valid for any function. So you can write any function here, any function here, and any function here. And this will be true. Yeah, so if you want, it's just, no. So basically, you want to connect this delta tilde to the delta which you know from before. Because you want to use the Euler-Lagrange equations. Euler-Lagrange equations deal with with normal delta. So in order to use them, you need to rewrite everything in terms of the old delta. Read the proof. I had to skip it. Sorry for that. But it's really three lines. And this is really the key point. So the less is just the rest is just an algebra, but the key point is to distinguish delta tilde from delta.
And that's just so that you can use the
exactly, yeah.
Which you wouldn't be able to use with the delta tilde.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you want to use the delta tilde because it's easier to find.
Because this delta tilde is the one which appears in Noether's theorem, so I have to somehow connect the delta tilde which appears here is the delta which appears here. Other questions?
How did you get the very last equation?
This one?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm skipping many lines here. So I'm just saying this is the result of the calculation. You'll find it's something that is proportional to Euler-Lagrange equations, which vanish on shell, and something which is basically a boundary term. OK. But yeah, there's three lines missing.
Delta twiddle there,
in
there.
So it's advantageous to rewrite, so you will have, for example, delta tilde of L,
yeah.
And it's better to rewrite it in terms of the old delta, and then you can use Euler-Lagrange equations and stuff like that. Just read it in the notes.